basically want to know anything about Ireland, where it sits in the world, and on the world stage. No better person to discuss this with other than our ambassador, Ireland's ambassador to the United States. Again, Your Excellency, I'll only say this once because you don't like
it. That's too many times.
All right. His Excellency, Daniel Mulholl. Dan, by your choice, you don't like to ride with that title, which is so richly deserved. Has that anything to do with the fact about growing up in Ireland, and in particular Waterford? Maybe you could bring us back to those early
days. Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, looking back on it now, I had a very happy childhood. Parents who were devoted to the welfare and the upbringing of their six children. You know, we took our holidays every year, went all over the country, really. My father was a great believer in getting away for a couple of weeks or a week or two every year and having a family holiday. And we had, you know, family holidays at caravan parks in different parts of the country. So it was a very, I didn't have a global vision. I didn't know much about the wider world, except that I was a stamp collector, which I suppose is my first window on the world. None of my family had any connection with diplomacy or even with the public service. I mean, my mother was one of eight. And believe it or not, she was born late 20s. And believe it or not, all eight of her family spent their lives in Waterford.
Wow.
And my mother went away to England for 6 months. And as she put it herself, she ran home out of it. She didn't really like living outside of Waterford. In fact, I remember as a child when we would be coming back after our week or two weeks away from Waterford, as we crossed the bridge there over the river shore into Waterford City, you know, my mother would say, "I wouldn't give up a day in Waterford for a month anywhere else."
Wow.
So she was devoted to her Waterford life because all of her sisters and brothers and her mother was there, and that was her. She was very rooted in Waterford. My father was an only child. His father had come from Dublin. He was a bus driver in Waterford. So my father was an only child, and growing up, I had about 50 cousins in Waterford, but I had no cousins anywhere else in the world. So, unlike most Irish families, I didn't have the experience of a cousin coming home from England for the summer and getting a sense from that cousin of what the outside world was like. The first time I ever left Ireland, I was about 15. My parents decided to visit some very good friends of theirs from Waterford who had emigrated to London and then had moved to Torquay in Devon. And that was my first time outside of Ireland. And it was quite a revelation, you know, going to a country that was, very different from Ireland in those days. I mean, I remember, you know, my father being very daunted, driving on the motorways in London, and I was I was a navigator. I was the eldest, so I was a navigator sitting in the front seat, trying to, make sure we didn't get take the wrong turn and get lost somewhere in Middle England. But that was a very enjoyable. So I had a very enjoyable childhood, but it wasn't privileged. I went to a Christian Brothers school in Waterford. It wasn't privileged, but we were well looked after by my parents. My father had a good job. My mother was a homemaker, and she spent all of her time really caring for her six children. And I was delighted that, when I had my first ambassadorial assignment in Malaysia, that both of my parents were still around, and they actually came out to Malaysia for 3 or 4 weeks with my aunt. It gave them an opportunity to see, that I had, managed to become an ambassador at that stage. I was very glad that they were able to, to see me acting as an ambassador for Ireland, because this was something that would have been completely out of their range of aspiration and ambition. I mean, both my parents were, you know, we were intelligent people. They were, my father was very active in the Vincent de Paul and in the parish council and in the, you know, the Parent Teacher Association and so on. So he was quite active locally. My mother, you know, was very much rooted in the home and in, you know, spent a lot of her time with her sisters, you know, going down, you know, to the center of Waterford and, you know, going to mass and then doing a little bit of shopping and having a cup of coffee and coming home again. That was her kind of, so I didn't have any sense, you know, of huge entitlement. So, when I went to Cork in 1972, my expectation was that I would have come back to Waterford and would have, you know, got a job in the local school as a teacher. That was the kind of my ambition at the time, because that was the main role model that I had, was the teachers in my school at Mount Sion in Waterford, which is the first Christian Brothers school in the world, as you may know. But when I looked at Cork, I started to see that there was maybe a bigger horizon, and I started to think about other things I might do, and ended up in foreign affairs.
Now, that would have been, you know, a bit of a stretch, but you know, you had so many options at that point when you were talking about, you know, the civil service and public service. Had you thought in terms of, you know, being assigned to far-flung places to, you know, throughout the world? Some of them we'd have to look up on the map. You know, you had not only Malaysia,
yeah,
Germany, you had, well, the UK was...
Well, India was my first posting, which was a really exotic place to go in those days in the early 80s.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you, though.
Sure. So, if your first assignment is to India, did you have a Rolodex? Did you, you know, did you look up and say, okay, where do we start? Who do I meet in India? Or, you know, or did you become the Pied Piper in terms of leading the Irish into India, which would be indeed only a fantasy or a stretch? But how did that happen? I mean, how did you wind up?
Well, you know, I mean, I joined the Department of Foreign Affairs in 1978. I joined really almost by accident rather than design. A friend of mine showed me an ad in the Irish Times for a junior diplomat, trainee diplomat in the Department of Foreign Affairs. And my immediate response was, well, I don't speak any foreign languages. At the time, I had just English and Irish. And I thought, well, you know, it's not for me. And now a friend of mine had just that summer had said to me that she'd been in Paris and she'd had occasion to go into the embassy and met the third secretary there, the junior diplomat at the embassy in Paris, and thought the job was quite interesting, and thought it might be the kind of job that I would like to do. Now, I kind of dismissed that and said, no, it can't be. But anyway, eventually, you know, I made the application, and to my surprise, I was called for interview, and I was offered a job. And at that time, I suppose my ambition had changed. I looked to become an academic. I had a scholarship to do a PhD in Australia, and I decided to give that up and to try this foreign affairs lark for a couple of years. Well, that was 42 years ago, so it's been a bit of a while. But anyway, my first 2 years in Dublin, I worked on the European Union for about a year, and then I was transferred to our development aid section. That was at the very early stages of what's now called Irish Aid, where we were, you know, and I was given responsibility for Lesotho in Southern Africa, and I went there. I was assigned there to replace our you know, the colleague there who came home on leave, and I was sent out. So I spent about 6 weeks in Lesotho, which is my first time really living abroad, properly speaking. And then I came back from there, and I got word that I was to go to India. Now, my other colleagues at the time who were about to go on postings were going to Paris and Geneva and New York and Boston and Chicago and places like that. And here was I going to India. And I didn't know anything about India at all. But I started reading about it, and I started being told that it was actually a fascinating place in which to live. So I set off at the end of March 1980, and I flew to Paris first. In fact, I remember a cousin of mine was going to the World Cross Country Championships, and John Tracy was running that year. He'd won the previous 2 years, and he'd won the previous year in Limerick, and he was defending his title in Paris. So on the way to India, I stopped off in Paris, and I attended the World Cross Country Athletics Championships and cheered on John Tracy, who didn't win that day, unfortunately. But it was a great way to kind of ease myself out of Ireland. So I arrived in India. You know, in those days, Adrian, remember, you couldn't phone home from India at mm-hmm. that stage, right?
That's
so
true.
I didn't speak to my family for a full year.
My God.
There was obviously no internet. There was not. There wasn't even any television. Television in India only started when I was there, and it wasn't of that much interest because it was mainly sort of government programming that wasn't of much value. So I used to go to the airport every Saturday morning to pick up a diplomatic bag, and I would bring it back to my home. And I would divide up the mail for the ambassador and the first secretary and myself, and the bag would contain six Irish Times from the previous week, and a copy of a couple of the weekend newspapers from the previous weekend in Ireland. Right, so that was our main source of information on Ireland, and that information was usually, at least 3 or 4 days old, and in some cases 10 days old. But that was the highlight of the week, was picking up the diplomatic bag, because for example, we got a telex every morning from the Department of Foreign Affairs summarizing the news in Ireland, right? So it was a one A4 page news summary done by a young diplomat who came in at 6 in the morning and summarized the news and sent it off to all of our missions around the world. So we would get that in the morning. And that was our only news feed. And in those days, they didn't include the sports results. So, you could be waiting to know whether your team had succeeded in an All-Ireland Championship game or not. In my case, of course, I'm from Waterford, so there wasn't that much success. But I remember I was a great fan of Waterford soccer as well. And I'd been to 3 FAI Cup finals watching Waterford. And the aggregate score had been 8-0 against Waterford, 3-0 against Shamrock Rovers, 3-0 against Cork Hibernians, and 2-0 against Dundalk. And the year that Waterford won the Cup, for the first time since 1937, and the only time since then, I was in New Delhi, and I only got the result a week after the event. So there was a strange world in those days. But what you did was, I was the first person assigned there as a third secretary, so I had no predecessor. And I had to make my own way. So what I started to do was I started to make contact with academics in Delhi, and I discovered that there was a great interest in Irish literature. And because I was a Yeats sort of, I had done my master's on W.B. Yeats, I was able to give talks in various places. And I remember once, let me tell you this story now. One day in early, sometime in 1981, no, it was 82 actually, a friend of mine I'd met, an Indian friend of mine, I'd met her, and she decided to marry a British friend of mine, a British diplomat, and the couple invited me to be their best man at their wedding. So I said, great, delighted to do it. So her grandmother, who was a woman in her early 80s at the time, invited this round to lunch. Her grandmother was the sister of Jawaharlal Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, and one of the great political figures of the 20th century. And when I got to her home, we sat down at the table, all the family were on a big table, big house in one of the suburbs of New Delhi. She said, oh, you're Irish. And I said, yes. And she said, I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree in a small cabin built there of clay and wattles made. And she recited the entire poem by heart. And then she went on to recite When You Were Old and Grey and Full of Sleep and Nodding by the Fire. And I said to her, Mrs. Pandit, where did you learn those poems? And she said, I learned them when I was interned by the British during the 1930s with my brother as part of our independence struggle. And because Yeats was a nationalist, he was someone that we really revered. I learned his poems and I've never forgotten them. And I thought, wow, isn't that quite something? Here's a woman from the most powerful and influential Indian family of the 20th century who has a passionate interest in Irish literature and Irish culture. And that lesson has never left me.
you know, we'd love to sooner or later get to your role here as Ireland's ambassador to the U.S. Well, sure. I can't get there yet because there is a contribution which you make, indeed, not only to the United States, but, you know, to, in particular, the Irish diaspora worldwide. And that is you start your day. Now, thanks to the Internet and Twitter and, you know, your command of, you know, the use of social media, which the rest of us, some of us have, you know, we're still in baby infants there. But your poems and the inspiration that comes from those poems, where and how do you make that selection? Because it seems like, you know, ironically, you know, some of us, you are rekindling, you know, the a lot of those, again, poems and in some cases party pieces, you know, that depict an Ireland of culture. And how do you get into the realm of making, you know, each day out of an interesting day across the board, you know, for those who are totally into culture, and those might be, you know, just have a passing interest.
Yeah, well, I started doing this in 2015 for the 150th anniversary of the birth of W.B. Yeats. I've always been a Yeats enthusiast. I'm now actually the honorary president of the Yeats Society since last November. Mm-hmm. So I have a kind of a further interest in Yeats now. And I've written a lot about Yeats. I've lectured on him all over the place, probably on four continents at this stage, I reckon. I said I would commemorate Yeats's 150th anniversary of his birth, I would do a daily Yeats quote. And I did it for the whole year. And in fact, on some days like his birthday on the 13th of June, I did a dozen quotes maybe. And then for Poetry Day, I did a dozen quotes. So I probably did 450 Yeats quotes in the course of the full year. And I realized that it was very popular because people came back to me on Twitter to say how much they enjoyed it. And at the end of the year, I was about to drop this whole idea and move on and do something else. And I started getting people coming to me and saying, you must keep this going. You really must keep it going. It's wonderful. We love it. It's the best thing I see on Twitter all day long. And I just, you know, I wake up and the first thing I do is I check your Twitter feed to see what the quote is today. So I thought, okay, I'll keep it going. And I started then quoting from other Irish poets. And I've quoted everyone from, I have a book of early Irish lyrics, which were written in Irish and translated into English, which are wonderful, like of Pango Born and so on, you know, the cat, and you know, that wonderful poem of the cat and the monk. And I, it's anything from a medieval Irish poem in translation to poems by, you know, quite young Irish authors like Jessica Traynor, who's currently poet in residence at the Yeats Society, Quailin Hughes, who's a young Irish poet, and Sean Sexton, and so on. So I try to do the whole range. But a lot of what I do, obviously, is poetry that, you know, Patrick Kavanagh, Seamus Heaney, Austin Clark, poems that will be familiar to Irish people. And I really like when I hear back from somebody when I tweet, say, an Austin Clark poem or you know, The Planter's Daughter or a Lost Heifer or a Kavanagh poem like Epic. And people write back and say, wow, that was my father's favorite poem and my mother loved that poem. I remember that poem from school. So it does rekindle memories. I've had enormously positive. I mean, nobody has ever written anything nasty to me about, you know, my poetry tweets. So I'm determined now to keep it going. What I do is every evening I sit down, I look at my bookshelf. I have a big collection around. I've never written a poem, by the way. I've never written a line of poetry. I can't write it, but I do appreciate it. And I've acquired over the years a fairly substantial library of Irish poetry, and I delve into that, and I just pick up a book I haven't seen, haven't read for a while. I pull it out, I read through it, and I find six or seven lines which I put in to my tweet, and then I tweet it the following morning at usually 7 a.m. when I wake up. The first thing I do is I tweet the poem that I've put into my phone the previous evening. And then since the lockdown, since the stay-at-home period of our lives started there back in March, I have been doing a daily poetry reading, which I normally post around noon Washington time. And there I choose short poems, and I've done now probably about 40 or so in the last few weeks. And this morning I'll probably run to the garden because it's a nice, bright, sunny day here in Washington, and I'll record something down there and put that out. And that's also received a very positive response. So it's a question of, I do believe that poetry is one of our brand identifiers for Ireland. I hate using the word brand because it's probably not the right word. It sounds like I'm trying to use literature. But I do think that we are, one of the things that marks us out as a people, as a nation, is our strength in literature, our ability as storytellers, and our flair for poetry, because we do have a lot of very fine poets in Ireland. One of them died recently, sadly, Evan Boland, who has spent a lot of her life here in the United States, in California. But we do have a very strong tradition of poetry, and I feel that tradition is worth venerating, celebrating, and drawing on, especially at a time like this when we all need inspiration.
And boy, do we! That's great. Now, in having been, and it would appear that when we have a disaster such as COVID-19, the coronavirus, that would be indeed, and it is, it's a total shock to each and every one of us. But you've actually been in your missionary postings, your mission postings throughout the world. You were in Malaysia. I would hope it wasn't when you had your father and mother over as...
No, it wasn't. They left by then, yeah.
But talk about something that, that came out of nowhere, as did in the current situation. A tsunami. We can barely grasp, the what a tsunami is, were it not indeed for... the television and reports. Now, what about you? When did you learn, as a diplomat and representative, of Ireland? And what was your immediate reaction?
Right. Well, actually, I remember it vividly because it was about noon in Kuala Lumpur, and I had just been out. I think I had a game of tennis with my son. My son was visiting for Christmas, and my whole family, not my parents, but my children were out, and in fact some of my wife's family were from Australia. My wife's from Perth in Western Australia, and they were up. So we had a fairly full house, and we were all, I'd been out playing tennis with my son, and we came back, I had a shower, and we were about to sit down to have lunch, the whole family, and I got a phone call from Dublin, and it was the duty officer in the Department of Foreign Affairs. The Department of Foreign Affairs has in normal times and in emergencies as well, has a permanent person who's available all the time, to take phone calls in emergencies. And this person rang me, a young diplomat, rang me to say, Ambassador, can you tell us about what's happened with the tidal waves in Malaysia? And I said, well, tidal wave, what are you talking about? And she said, well, there are media reports here that a tidal wave has struck Malaysia. And we wondered, could you give us any information? So I'll have to check it. And so I went upstairs and turned on Malaysian television. There was nothing on Malaysian television at all about it. Now, of course, Kuala Lumpur is inland. So, no tsunami could possibly reach Kuala Lumpur. I switched to CNN, and they were showing pictures of, devastation from Thailand and from some parts of Malaysia and Indonesia. So I spent that afternoon on the phone to Irish people in the northern part of Malaysia, because I quickly discovered that it was the tsunami had struck the northern part of Malaysia and Thailand and Indonesia, mainly Indonesia, but also Thailand was badly struck as well. So I rang around to all of my contacts, Irish people, and they all confirmed that there had been, a tsunami which had struck Penang and Langkawi and places like that. And but they all indicated that it didn't appear to be a particularly destructive experience for northern Malaysia. Then I started to phone people in Thailand, and I discovered that Thailand was the epicenter of the crisis. So the following day, I was accredited to Thailand. The following day, I flew to Phuket in Thailand, because of the way the Irish now travel globally, there were probably 1,000, maybe more than 1,000, maybe thousands of Irish people in Thailand at that stage, on holidays. It was, in the middle of winter in Ireland and nice weather in Thailand, so people naturally travel there. And my aim, my job then, I was there for 3 weeks solid. I didn't come back for 3 weeks. I basically worked from 7 in the morning until late at night. The first week was horrendous because, there were open-air morgues in a place like Thailand, which is hot country and the heat is intense all year round. And it was chaotic. But having said that, the Thais, I thought, handled it very well in that the first day I went there, I went to this center where they were giving out food and they were giving out water, they were giving out clothing to people, because a lot of people had actually lost everything. I mean, they'd literally lost everything. Yeah. And I was there and met some Irish people who told me their experiences, and I was able to give them temporary passports to get them home. So the initial phase was getting people home. Then it was trying to track down the injured. There were a number of Irish people who were injured, and I remember discovering a group of young men from Ireland who were in a hospital in Thailand. I actually discovered them, and I went there and I got them onto a plane from Phuket to Bangkok, and I arranged then for our honorary consul in Bangkok. We didn't have an embassy in Bangkok at the time. We do have now, to make sure that they got on the next flight to Ireland. And a couple of them, all of them were badly shaken. A few of them had physical injuries, and one was on a stretcher. A couple of them were on a stretcher when they left. But I actually accompanied them to the airport and made sure that they got on this Thai military flight that was flying injured people from Phuket to Bangkok. And after that, then, once that phase had ended, it was then a case of searching for the remains of Irish people who had been lost. And in the end, we had four Irish people who lost their lives in the tsunami, but there were many, many more who were in the area. And at the beginning of the crisis, we had 1,000 names of people who had been reported from home to have been in the area. So it was a very trying and challenging time of my life, but I was happy that I was able to provide genuine assistance and support to Irish people who were genuinely in very serious need of that support. And that's when diplomats come into their own. In my view, there's nothing more important than helping Irish people in distress, because all the other things we do are vitally important to our country and to our interests and to our values. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is that your first and last duty is to look after Irish people.
And rightly so, because that is our tradition, through centuries. Irish people,
yes,
excuse the pun, but under the gun, would in fact naturally, get together, combine their efforts with nothing. No mercenary, benefits or in mind. Just get together. I think it comes naturally to us, because of our heritage, because of those who spent a lifetime, well, got pretty good practice with that, for at least 800 years, and we leave it at that. But that's what we do. And it's something that's, I think, part of our DNA.
I agree. And I've seen that. I've seen it all over the place. I've seen it in Malaysia, when a number of the Irish community in Phuket were very helpful to me and trying to support what I was trying to do there and helping me to search for Irish people who are missing and so on. And then I've seen it also in London, where, you know, the Irish community, they are very much integrated, supporting some of the elderly Irish and some of the Irish who maybe not as you haven't done, you know, may have financial or health or other challenges facing them. There's a lot of Irish organizations there in Britain that are very supportive of our community. And the same is true here in the United States, where I've been very impressed in the last few months of the way in which Irish organizations have come together to try and support those in need during the COVID crisis.
And that actually brings us a little closer to, you know, the topic of the day, which is that, you know, when Irish organizations who enjoy their own independence, when their feet is to, you know, or to the fire, they get together. There's no big ceremony. There's no transition necessary. They just do it. It's there. And we have the organizations here, you know, obviously Sláinte.
Yeah, very impressed by that, yeah. Yeah,
you have Sláinte, and then you have the AOH's Mehel. They are organizations that are doing more of the same. They don't have to learn the job. They know what the job is. And to that end, I think it's simply terrific. It's great. Irish government, Ambassador, the Irish government has never abandoned the diaspora. And I think as an ethnic group, we're in first place by a mile. The Irish government does not, it simply does not say, so long and now God bless. They say, so long, we'll stay in touch. And that's what they do, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's been a big feature of the last, I'd say, 20 years in particular, that there's been a greater emphasis on the diaspora and on the need for a two-way channel between Ireland and our diaspora around the world. Funding has been made available over the years to support Irish organizations abroad. We've organized various events in Ireland, bringing the diaspora back to listen to what they have to say. I believe that as we try to engineer our economic recovery over the next few years, that the diaspora will play a major role in helping us to come out of the crisis that undoubtedly will be created by the coronavirus.
All right. You know, not everybody has, gotten that message. If we, you know, down in your own bailiwick there of Washington, without delving into it, the current administration has, implied, insinuated that perhaps, you know, a cure to getting America, to get America, you know, restarted would be to, say, yank, American companies from different places. But somehow Ireland comes to the top of the list. It's like, okay, we got to bring all these successful companies, you know, American companies back from Ireland, with total disregard for the fact that Irish companies in the United States provide double, give or take, double the amount of employment, you know, to Americans. Big cheeky.
Yeah. Well, look. This is. Obviously, things are said and you know, in the heat of the moment and so forth. But I think if you stand back and look at this situation logically and rationally, what you discover is that American businesses benefit hugely from being able to operate in a place like Ireland and be able to cover the markets of the European Union, 500 million people and beyond, because, of course, our U.S. companies in Ireland don't just cover the European Union, they cover the rest of Europe and the Middle East and Africa in many cases. And they do that tariff-free because the EU has so many free trade agreements with the countries surrounding the European Union and the Middle East and so on. So they benefit from being able to operate in Ireland, and they export all over the world from Ireland. Now, sometimes here in the US, you get criticism of the fact that we have a substantial surplus in goods, in manufactured goods trade with the United States. And that sometimes comes into the public arena here, and it can be criticized and so on. Now, the reason for that is quite simple. It's not because there are Irish companies in Ireland producing stuff and flooding the American market with cheap goods. No. Our surplus in manufactured goods is made up entirely of exports from Ireland by U.S. companies, mm-hmm. U.S. multinationals, especially the top 10 pharma companies who are based in Ireland. And the way the pharma sector works, as I understand it, is that they have plants all over America, and they have plants in Europe, in Asia, maybe in Africa, wherever. So they have a global supply chain. And certain drugs, they manufacture exclusively in Ireland, because that's the most efficient way of doing it. You manufacture a particular drug in one place, and you cover the whole world from there. And with pharma, it's relatively easy because they're valuable products, but they're also light, so transporting them around, is not a problem. And some blockbuster drugs are manufactured in Ireland. And let me give you a figure. In 2018 was the last year I have figures for. We exported about $100 billion worth, and I'm translating now from euro to dollars, but it's $100 billion worth of pharma, pharmaceutical products from Ireland, right?
Yeah.
And about $35 billion of that went to the United States. So what happens is that a blockbuster drug is manufactured in Ireland, it's exported all over the world, and of course part of that export goes to the United States. But the benefit for those American companies is that they can access markets all over the world from Ireland. They can access them tariff-free and into the European Union. It makes it very efficient to service a market of nearly 500 million people. And they can then also export to other places which have trade agreements with the European Union, which means the barriers are reduced. And the profits those companies make, they come back to the United States to the benefit of the U.S. economy, ultimately. So this is a win for us because we get the employment in Ireland, high-skilled employment in the main. It's a win for the American businesses because they get to operate efficiently. They become global companies, which makes them truly strong and great in global terms. And the profits go back to the United States. Besides which, although we have a surplus with the U.S. in the manufactured goods area, we have a big deficit when it comes to services. So we import a lot more services from the United States. I'm talking about intellectual property and so forth than we export to the U.S. So overall, our trade is actually quite balanced. And I think people in the United States understand these things. And ultimately, when they come to make decisions about the future. And by the way, the companies that are in Ireland are private companies. They're not owned by the American government.
Yeah.
You know, they're private companies that operate in accordance with the best interest of their own company and their shareholders. So I believe that when people look at Ireland in the future, they will see that Ireland is a perfectly set place for U.S. companies to invest and to operate from because of the advantages they derive from that. And that Furthermore, the supply chains from Ireland to the US have remained totally open in the last few months. So even a pandemic hasn't actually created shortages. And I think you will find that the aircraft that are currently flying from Dublin to New York, Boston, Chicago, are not flying because they're full of passengers. They probably have very few passengers, but they have lots of cargo. And that cargo, a lot of that cargo, is actually medical supplies coming in from Ireland to the United States. So I think this argument, when it's made about, you know, jobs being transferred and manufacturing being transferred back to the United States, I think sensible people here will realize that transferring these kind of operations back from Ireland would make no sense at all. It would actually be a negative from the point of view of the American economy.
Ambassador General Hall, you are, you know, the conduit for Ireland, for the Irish, to the U.S. Congress,
yes.
And in that, in fact, to the White House.
Yes.
A very important role for just about any country. That's why we have, you know, a diplomatic agencies and presence in all the countries. But you have, you know, this access to Congress. You have access to, you know, a Congress that, you know, used to be, let's just say for the sake of it used to have more Irish names, it, you know, easily identified. But actually, you reach out and you know, you talk to Congress in general without any distinction between Republican or Democrat.
Yes, because every... I mean, obviously, we have a special relationship with people that have an Irish background. Hmm. But by the way, you know, the names don't always tell the full story, by the way. I mean, one of our firmest friends in Congress is Congressman John Larson from Connecticut. Now, his father, obviously, was Swedish background, but John Larson, Congressman Larson, is one of the most Irish Americans you could imagine, because on his mother's side, and I think even partly on his father's side, the background is mainly Irish, and he's very proud of his Irish roots. So, you know, you often discover that people with names that don't, you know, Senator Lisa Murkowski, you know, when she came to open the Robert Emmett Park in D.C. beside the embassy where there's a statue of Robert Emmett. It's been there for 50 years, but they decided to make it a national park. We had a ceremony last September. She came and said to me, sure. She said, I'm mainly Irish-American, by the way. She said, my name is Polish, but most of my background is Irish, you know. So it's you know, but even beyond that, I mean, I remember meeting Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy from Florida, who actually came on one of the delegations that came to Ireland last year. Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy has no Irish background. She's Vietnamese, I think, but she's married to a man called Murphy. Yeah. So, you know, there are complicated, you know, strings and so on, complicated, you know, connections and strands of connection that we have. But our aim is to, you know, to reach out to you know, the Congress as a whole and to find interlocutors, you know, across the board. And I'm, you know, very happy to, you know, to meet and engage with people that have absolutely no Irish connection. Because a lot of them have Irish constituents, for example, so they're interested in that point of view. Some of them have an interest in Ireland for whatever reason. They may have studied there, they may have some family connection that's not a birth connection, but maybe their spouses or whatever have Irish connections, or their children have studied there. So there are lots of ways in which you can engage with people. And I think we should leave no stone unturned, because the more people you engage with in this life, this diplomatic life, the better it is. This is a job that requires you to push the boat out every day to find people to talk about. Because, frankly, part of our job is Ireland's story, and to make sure Ireland's story is properly understood by people of influence across the system here. And you have to keep telling that story day in, day out, to as many people as you can find that will listen to your story. Because I'm afraid the fate of a country of our size is to be ignored. And we in Ireland have big resources that enable us to be heard because of our culture, our literature, because of our connections with America, to Irish America. But we have to keep telling our story. We have to keep reminding people about us, because otherwise stereotyped images of Ireland could, you know, come back to our detriment.
And
so we've got to present that image of Ireland as a culturally interesting country, but also a country that has a cutting-edge economy, has a relevance to America in terms of its historical links, but also in terms of its contemporary relevance.
And particularly at this time when, you know, say, Brexit has moved in terms of significance, you know, to the back burner, overshadowed. It it has to be amazing success to have United States Congress. You know, you're talking about names that may have little or no Irish background, but take a Pelosi. You know, the Speaker of the House for the now, Democratic, the House. To have that, not, you know, just kind of fly over Ireland and go to Britain, and the message is pretty clear. It says,
yes.
The message is, wait a minute. Now, before you get into this, you know, we have a huge stake in how America is going to respond to Brexit, because it's going to, obviously, it's going to change, you know, the world and the economy and the European Union and all the rest of it. But it's amazing that right now, you know, you have America going to Britain and saying, this is what the story is. We have more than a passing interest. And we have a huge, huge stake in how Brexit and America are going to proceed after this.
We have, and you're right. Speaker Pelosi's intervention, along with Congressman Richie Neal and Congressman Brendan Boyle and others who went to Ireland on that trip. I actually accompanied them there. I was with the Speaker throughout her time in Ireland, and it was a very memorable visit. But you're right that she went not just to Ireland, but also to Britain. And there was a famous meeting between the Speaker and her delegation and some of the strong Brexiteers in Britain, who sort of tried to, I think it's fair to say, tried to bully the Speaker, or, you know, tried to chastise her for her position. And she responded with, you could imagine, it was quite a firm position, and told them clearly that if Brexit led to the creation of a border on the island of Ireland, there would be no trade deal between the UK and the USA, because the Congress would simply not approve it, and that would be the end of it. And I think that was a kind of a sobering wake-up call for some of the more adamant Brexiteers in Britain, to discover that actually their cherished hope of a special trade deal, a quick and beneficial trade deal with the United States, was going to be potentially dashed because of the border issue on the island of Ireland. And I've no doubt but that was part of the reason why, in the end, a deal was done in October of last year between the EU and the UK to avoid, for the future, any possibility of a border on the island of Ireland. No, we have to watch that, because Britain hasn't, you know, the transition period is still going on, and they won't finally leave until the end of this year, or maybe even later if they decide to delay the negotiations because of the coronavirus crisis. And we have to wait and see. But at the moment, it's looking like that agreement to do with Northern Ireland and the border in Ireland will be upheld. But we have to keep an eye on that, and we're very vigilant on that one. And indeed, our friends here in the United States are also watching that carefully. And then, of course, we have to look at the trade deal between the UK and the US, which is being negotiated, which will take longer, I think, than people believe to conclude, because it's quite a complicated agreement that they'll have to make between the two sides, and there will be differences of opinion between them, and they'll have to resolve those. We've got to make sure that that deal respects the provisions of the protocol on Northern Ireland, which is part of the EU-UK deal, and that's where our friends in Congress will be invaluable to us yet again.
Ambassador Dan Mulhall, thank you for joining us, and there are indeed so many topics that we didn't get around to, but it is great to get that one kind of out and there so that there is no confusion whatsoever. Yeah. As to, and it's also, this is a showcase of, wait a minute, Ireland is not independent of America. The U.S. is not independent of Ireland. When not just the Gráinne Creagh lovely relationship through the years and that great emotional, connection, but from a business standpoint, particularly at this point, we have to start all over. But obviously, with many issues, including the economy, and this is our position. And thank you for getting that message out.
Yeah, no, I mean, I believe Irish America will be absolutely vital to our recovery in the coming years. I hope that next year we'll see the biggest and the best St. Patrick's Day celebration ever here in the United States. I hope that once travel becomes safe again and people want to travel, that we will have a bumper year next year of Americans visiting Ireland. I hope that we will continue to see Irish America connecting with Ireland, having an affiliation with Ireland, an admiration for Ireland, and an association with Ireland, because that benefits our country enormously. We would be a much smaller country in world affairs if we didn't have the influence of the Irish in America on our side. I thank them all for that. I also thank the organizations all over the country. Sláinte 2020 in New York, the organizations have come together there to provide for the welfare needs of the Irish community. Similar things happening in Boston, in Chicago, in San Francisco. This shows the true spirit of the Irish that will never be crushed and cannot be crushed even in the face of this virus. In fact, a challenge like this brings out the best in the Irish. Thank you very much. Go to me, Margaret.
Go to me, Margaret.